Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. The issues are complicated, but the facts are simple. Global decisions on trade, aid, HIV/AIDS, and women's rights threaten the very livelihood of the poor. We hear about one organisation that has taken up the challenge to change things. Prison chaplains. They're sources of food, medicine, literacy. They connect with families and intervene in bureaucratic matters. But first of all, they're bearers of hope. And Father Jim Brand delves into the deep spirituality of the first three steps of the AA's 12-step program. Did you know that half the world, that's nearly 3 billion people, live on less than $2 a day? That the gross domestic product of the poorest 48 nations is less than the wealth of the world's three richest people combined? That nearly a billion people entered the 21st century unable to read a book or sign their names? The facts are dire, and the list goes on and on. I know about poverty, and I've seen it often, even in the streets of my very own rich city. But it's good to know that there are people and organisations committed to change the awful facts. Actually, the main UN Millennium Development Goal is the eradication of extreme poverty and hunger by the year 2015. And one of the organisations involved in working in that direction is ActionAid. Right now, it's wrapping up a project known as the Global Month of Action Against Poverty.
Well, the aims of the Global Month are really continuing from the movement that began in 2005, the Global Call to Action Against Poverty.
Emma Harbour is Campaigns Coordinator at ActionAid.
And we're made up of a massive coalition from over 100 countries, which represent a very diverse range of groups, from community groups to various faith groups, trade unions. And so there's quite a lot of diversity in our general calls. But together we're calling for steps to be taken to achieve the Millennium Development Goals and areas of public accountability around just governments and the fulfilment of human rights, trade justice, and major increase in the quantity and quality of aid and the financing for development and debt cancellation. And alongside all of that, we're calling for gender equality to be recognised as really a central issue if we're going to achieve poverty eradication.
Now, poverty is so wide-ranging in its terrible effects, its eradication must be a daunting challenge to take up. I asked Emma how the coalition goes about doing this.
Different countries are focusing on different areas. So this particular month of action has seen the International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings happening. So we've been focusing there around issues of governance and quality and quantity of aid. It's also encompassed a number of actions around trade justice and different countries calling on action either around kind of what happens now the World Trade Organization talks are in, have been suspended, and how countries can really achieve trade justice. Other countries are focusing much more around debt cancellation. So there's a number of different kind of focuses, depending on the country. In the UK, we've been calling, obviously, on action around the World Bank and our role as a major funder at the World Bank and the IMF. We're also looking at the European trade policies around economic partnership agreements and calling for kind of major changes in the proposed EPAs framework at the moment.
At this point, I was interested to know more about ActionAid itself. How large an organisation is it, I asked Emma, and which areas exactly does it tackle?
Our head office is now in Johannesburg in South Africa, but ActionAid actually has over 50 country offices around the world. A large portion of those are in Africa. We also have a number of offices in Asia and Latin America, as well as ActionAid affiliates in Europe. Within Africa, there's been a number of events, again, covering a wide range of different activities. But some of the things that have already happened have included in Sierra Leone, there was a mass rally before the World Bank and IMF meetings. They've had a large focus in Africa on the IMF and World Bank meetings around governance and hearing the voice of the poor at those meetings.
Emma, the facts on poverty are horrifying. Would you like to give me some figures?
Yes, certainly. I mean, as I think many people are aware, these days they are horrific and growing all the time. 30,000 children are dying needlessly every day from extreme poverty. Over 100 million children in the world's poorest countries don't attend primary school, and about two-thirds of those are girls. In some African countries, one in three people are HIV positive, and the life expectancy has now fallen to 33 in some of those countries. And while sub-Saharan Africa has just over 10% of the world's population, it's actually home to 60% of all people living with HIV. Almost half of the people in the world live on less than $2 a day, and one in six are living on less than a dollar a day. And so the global call to action against poverty is really trying to address some of the really fundamental causes of all of this. And as I mentioned earlier, we're also looking at the role that gender equality needs to play. And I think that's most dramatically seen in the fact that while women are producing 50% of the world's food, they actually own only 2% or less than 2% of the land.
Very sobering figures. What can the ordinary person do? How can we support the campaign?
There's a number of things that people can do, both during the month and ongoing. As you mentioned, ActionAid's a member of the Global Call to Action Against Poverty, and people can join ActionAid as campaigners to help us really target government and world leaders, both in the UK and internationally. And people can find out more about that at ActionAid's website, which is actionaid.org.uk. During the month of action, there's a Stand Up Against Poverty world record attempt, which is really to help draw attention to the number of people across the world who are concerned about this and who are taking action and are calling for more to be done by their governments. And people can arrange their own Stand Up Against Poverty world record events. They can find out more about that, again, through the ActionAid website. There's a toolkit that they can download. But the general purpose of the action is that if people are in their churches or community areas, people are asked to stand up for a minute while their leader kind of reads out a pledge which calls on governments to act and reach the Millennium Development Goals and really adds their name to the Stand Up Against Poverty movement. And there is a website that can be found through whiteband.org where all of these figures will be collected globally for a hand-in on the 17th of October, which is the World Poverty Day. Although, obviously, each country has its own individual focus, as you mentioned, but both through ActionAid, as I mentioned earlier, we do work in over 50 countries. So there is a number of local actions that people can take, as well as the global call actions later in the month.
So there's no excuse not to participate?
Not at all, no. There's definitely something for everyone to do, whether it's writing to their MP or whether it's taking part in an action. There's something that everyone can do.
One of the worst things I imagine that can happen to a person, to any person, is to be deprived of their freedom. And yet, in every corner of the world, large numbers of men and women find themselves incarcerated, justly or unjustly, for varying periods of time, in conditions that range from good to horrific. Whatever their story, whatever their sin, these people are all needy, isolated, and usually desperate. The Church is adamant they all deserve pastoral and spiritual care. Jesuit Father Winston de Souza is one of those special men, a prison chaplain, who responds to that need. He lives and works in Scotland, but popped into Vatican Radio just the other day to say hello and to share with us the difficulties and the rewards of his very particular mission.
I was invited to join prison chaplaincy subsequent to my finishing off as parish priest at a previous parish. And I could say that over the 3 years, it has definitely been one of the high points of my life in Scotland, far better than being in a parish.
Father Winston told us he looks after the local jail in Aberdeen, and he takes care of a special prison at Peterhead for prisoners with sex-related offences. But first of all, he explained, he does not make distinctions between prisoners, not even between those who may be evidently innocent and hardened criminals with no remorse.
I'm not a judge in civil law or in criminal law for that matter. So I'm not in a stage of making a judgment about people. Also, in my encounter with prisoners, I don't ordinarily ask what offense they are in for. I never ever ask them. If they want to speak about it, they're very welcome to speak about it. And I would listen to them. But I don't challenge them about their offense. Primarily because I think prison chaplaincy goes beyond the offense of a prisoner. Prison chaplaincy has got to do with holistic care of the prisoner, to give him a sense of what are the possibilities before him when he's out of prison. How can he kind of change himself from within? That, for me, is far more demanding, challenging, and of importance than just merely looking at the person's crime.
Surely, I thought, it's only human to want to discover the crime behind the man. But Father Winston said that's not the way to go. And not only that. If you're sensitive and open, it's often the criminal himself who can teach you something about yourself.
I had a prisoner in Peterhead not very long ago who was in for a crime, a sex-related crime, and he was in for about 5 years, I think. He wasn't a Christian, he wasn't Catholic, he was a Jain. But I did find him to have quite a sense of balance about his crime, and he opened my eyes to something quite different. You know, apparently in Jainism, they have this kind of understanding that if you do something evil in this world, you are punished for it in some form. You may not necessarily be punished for it immediately, but in some form, you will be punished. And punishment really is a cleansing experience. It's a time to sit down and reflect and think about what you've done and things like that. So although he has denied a lot of what he has done from the point of view of this crime that he was in for, he thinks that he's guilty of several other crimes in the past, which he's never ever been convicted for. For example, he said that he was, he's quite an elderly person really, and he was in the war as a pilot. And he says he remembers having killed people who he never ever met, but this was his job, to push buttons on a plane and to drop bombs. And today he feels a sense of remorse for those crimes because he thinks that is far more evil of what he did than what he's potentially in for, whatever sentence he completed. So you see, you get these kind of prisoners really, who sometimes open their eyes to things that you never ever thought of. And it's quite a formative experience.
Now, a prisoner has a strict routine and a program he has to adhere to. But for the chaplain himself, there are no fixed rules and regulations. He's there to accompany the prisoner, walk with him in this most difficult time of his life.
Yes, I think you've put it quite accurately, if I may say so. Because prisoners are at different levels. You can't have one program, really, as a blanket program for all prisoners.
And of course, the prison chaplain has a different role from the warders, the director, and from everyone else who works in a prison. Father Winston says it's essential right from the beginning to establish oneself on a different plane in order to gain the prisoner's trust.
I joined in February of 2003, and for the first 6 months that I was in prison, nobody would come and speak to me. So I was just to walk around the halls and kind of see them playing table tennis or pool or snooker or whatever else, and you know, say hello, hi, you know, that kind of thing. And people used to come up to me, look at my badge, and say, and you know, just walk away. But over a period of time of 6 months, 7 months, then suddenly tides seems to change, you know, and they did come up to me and speak to me. And I asked a few prisoners, you know, why this? And they said, you know, initially when you came, prisoners really don't trust anybody outside themselves. They do not know who you are. They do not know whether you're going to grasp them in front of the governor or anybody else. You may profess to be a Catholic priest, but they still don't trust you. You know, it takes a long while to build trust in a person. But having built that trust, then they can talk to you about anything they want because they know that you will not shock them in front of the governor or in front of any of the other staff, really. My usual uniform to get into prison is a T-shirt and jeans and trainers. And that's how I go in. I'd never wear a collar except if it's something very formal in a prison. like I've got to meet a governor or there's the inspector of prisons or somebody coming over. And then, you know, as chaplain of the prison, I've got to be on my best behavior and in my uniform. But apart from that, ordinarily when I go to prison every day, it's just T-shirt, jeans and trainers. And prisoners like me that way because, you know, they resent anybody with a uniform. So that's one way in which you can kind of break down, break in really with them. And break down barriers of resistance that go on between. You know, I can sit down with them, have a wee chat with them, share some chewing gum or something like that with them.
So a prison chaplain is in fact someone who can and does wield enormous influence within a very difficult social context. He does this by confronting suffering, human rights challenges, and the mentality of despair. The church, Father Winston says, has much to do.
At the topmost level, I would say the church needs to engage with the justice system in a country. You need to have people from within the church who can sit at some of these meetings or some of these committees and present a different viewpoint, the holistic viewpoint. So when you're looking at justice, you're not just looking at justice for the victim, but we also need to restore dignity to the prisoner who often is victimized when they get out of prison by society. And as much as the prisoner feels victimized by society, that cycle of crime is not going to break. So we do need priests or somebody to give a holistic vision to the justice system. The second level is, I would like to see people from parishes involved in prisons as well. Why? Because several people from parishes have got gifts and talents that often prison chaplains don't have. Listening skills, music skills, a variety of other skills. For example, many of them have got contacts of how to get jobs. Many of them have got some kind of skills of how to kind of brighten up their CVs and things like that. You know, anything that helps in some shape or form to kind of get a prisoner back into a proper functioning member of society once again helps. So I think parishioners have got a lot to contribute as well. And at the third level, I would also like to see chaplains really involved far more also within the prison management system, to be, so to speak, advisors to governors and to deputy governors and people across the board, people that are really involved with the care and activities even of prisoners on an everyday level. Because my experience really has been that many of these managers within the prison service are quite professional at their own little job, but they fail to see the holistic side of things. You know, how can we get this prisoner back into society as a proper functioning member of society? They would look at it really, okay, how could I get him off drugs? But that really does not help, because when he gets out of prison, he's got a problem with money, he's got a problem with housing, he's got a problem with getting other things from society. So, you know, it's everything is required to kind of make a person feel whole again.
To make a person feel whole again, a person who feels broken inside. That's a big challenge. On the other hand, the idea of a prison chaplain, for me, goes hand in hand with hope. And I'm sure for the broken people inside those grim walls and behind the barred windows, they must be bearers of hope. They're also often sources of food, medicine, literacy. They connect with families and intervene in important bureaucratic matters. But first of all, they share God's love. They're essentially bearers of hope. And now Father Jim Brand, spiritual director of the Pontifical Beda College, continues in his journey into the deeply spiritual AA 12-step program. He explains how the first three steps are all about conversion.
Hello, it's Father Jim. Last week, I was beginning to think about the 12-step program that I was introduced to by some alcoholic friends. I was pointing out that for me, this was very redeeming because I came from an alcoholic family, and there were lots of things that I didn't understand and injuries I had from that sort of a background. And these wonderful, wonderful people, holy people, have given me more than I'm ever aware of giving them. And I was saying that there were four things that have taught me a lot. One is, we are all in this together. 2, don't look back. 3, just live for today. That's quite enough, just for today. And fourthly, we're all one drink away from ruination, so we can't condemn anybody. And I used to go to these open meetings we had in the parish. The place was made holy by the presence of these people, all ages, all sorts, all backgrounds. It was a real leveller. And a meeting will usually begin by, let's consider why we're here and give a thought for the suffering alcoholic. Real compassionate feelings. And then the person who's going to lead will ask somebody if they'd like to read the 12 steps of the programme and also the 12 traditions. And today I'd just like to start saying something about the 12 steps of this spiritual programme. The first 3 steps, I think, are what conversion is about. The first step is we, notice we, not just I, we, because we're all in this together, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I suppose without this first step, we can't really carry on because it's hitting reality. I think we never allowed my father to get too bad, to hit rock bottom. Always trying to protect him from that, because he might burn the house down. So in some ways we colluded with it. It's very difficult sometimes to let somebody hit the dust, bite the dust, and from there they can only go upwards. And I've noticed such patience in these groups with people, and they say, well, perhaps he's not ready yet. Perhaps she needs more time. But really, one can't get on with this programme until one admits that one's powerless. Alone, one's powerless. And in the whole area of virtue and sin, eventually we have to say, look, Lord, I can't do this on my own. I'm powerless. Now, I have absolutely no doubt that within the group there is a dynamism, the Holy Spirit, where two are gathered together, that is much more than the sum of the parts. It's this support they give each other, not only in meetings, and some may go to more than 2 meetings a day. We always used to have extra ones on Christmas Day because that was a particularly difficult time, and everyone's saying, have a drink, you're not drinking, we must be a drip, we must be wet, you see. And also for some of them, Christmas was a painful time because of past miserable Christmases they'd all had together. So I was always very impressed at the support they give each other. There's phone services, people can ring up phone lines and chat. They tend to have quite a lot of high phone bills, but also you're given a sponsor who's your special friend, usually somebody who's been sober for a while and understands the programme, a sponsor who's always available for you, so that you're not alone. Together we'll do this. So the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become manageable. Then second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Oh, there's lots to learn there. They always talk about a higher power. You can only look upwards now because you've hit rock bottom. And whatever you call your God, as you understand him, must always be a higher power. And I wish Christians would have a God that's always a higher power. I know some Christians who are walking saints, but the God they worship is a devil. Less loving than they are, less virtuous, less forgiving. Terrifying God someone's infected them with. So when you're rock bottom, all you can do is to look up to what will always be a higher power. and praying to that higher power to restore us to sanity. Because their wisdom sees their condition as an illness that affects the body, it affects the spirit and one's emotions. It's a sort of total illness. And therefore, they need to be helped for people to understand more about this illness. And really, the alcoholics I've met, including my father, when they don't drink, there's no one more wonderful in the world. It seems to affect sometimes the loveliest, wonderful people. Then, having turned to a higher power, you make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And in life, I'm sure our understanding of the higher power grows. The relationship grows, as with everything else in life, it either grows or deteriorates. And these first three steps are what I see as conversion. Facing truth, alone it's impossible. Turning to what must be a higher power, because I can't help myself. And then handing one's life over to the care of that higher power. For me, that is conversion. And knowing and loving these people have helped me understand conversion more. I still miss them, all those weekends we used to spend together on one of the 12 steps. And one thing that has always touched me is how grateful they are. Some of them are Scots. And at the end of the weekend, they used to have what they call a gratitude meeting. When they went round and they just shared what their reason for gratitude was. It wasn't just me, but that God has kept them safe. Amazing Grace is one of their favourite hymns. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, now I see. And they're so grateful for small mercies. And that taught me lots about our Lord, who's always so grateful. I thank you, Father, for the work you've given me to do. I thank you for the friends you've given me. I thank you for listening to my prayer. I'm grateful for a cup of water. And the humility and simplicity of these friends doing the 12 steps has opened a new world of reconciliation to me with my past. And I'm very happy to pass what I've received on to you, especially if there's any of you out there suffering. Remember, if this is a problem for you, go straight back to the meeting where you'll be received with love. And I'd further say, if you have problems with the church and you feel alienated, go straight back to the meeting, the Assembly of the Believers, and I hope you'll be welcomed with a great kiss. Amen.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program, Laudetur Jesus Christus.